In the kitchen, sitting in a basket, they discovered a pair of Under Armour gloves with a honeycomb pattern. Under the mattress, they found a black Ruger .380 caliber handgun. The magazine contained 6 rounds. A black and green Eagle Creek backpack hung in a closet in the computer room. It was stuffed with bags. One held a pair of clear plastic high heels with pink ribbons. Another was a clear plastic Ziploc bag. Neat block letters, scrawled with a black Sharpie, revealed the contents. Stockings, clamps, dildo, gag. In the back of the closet, Williams noticed a small black guitar amp. He turned it around. 2 plastic Ziploc bags peeked out of the back. Williams pulled them out. Montano placed the bags on the floor. Inside, she saw women's underwear. Peach and white striped, bright pink, white, light pink, brown, silky baby blue, and white with colored flowers. There were 10 pairs in all. His trophies. The abundance of evidence astonished every cop on the scene. It was like finishing a jigsaw puzzle. The jagged pieces formed a clear picture. Mark O'Leary. As a detective, you serve search warrants all the time. Sometimes you find good stuff. Sometimes you find a little bit. But you don't usually find almost every single thing that ties a case to every other case, Hassel says. There was so much stuff, you're like, this is silly. After the arrest, Galbraith drove over to Amber's new apartment. It had been 39 days since the rape. She wanted to break the news. Amber met her outside in the parking lot. Galbraith told her that the man's name was Mark O'Leary, that he'd raped other women before her, that Amber had helped to solve the case, her attention to detail, her ability to draw him into conversation, her instincts on his background, her phone call to police. Galbraith rarely got emotional, but now she felt overwhelmed, with relief, with satisfaction, with happiness. She began to tear up. I did this for you, she thought. Amber showed no emotion. She thanked Galbraith, she gave her a quick hug, and then she went back inside the apartment. Galbraith had wanted more of a reaction, even though she knew better. It wasn't her emotion to have. A victim's experience of rape was intensely personal. Hendershot called Sarah. They needed to meet, Hendershot told her. Sarah said she was busy running errands. She didn't know if she had time to get together. Well, it's really, really important, Hendershot told her. I'll go anywhere you are. I don't care where you're at. I'll go anywhere. That evening, Hendershot drove to meet her at a Denny's restaurant. Hendershot saw her in a back corner, eating alone. Sarah had no family nearby. Her husband had died. She had suffered over and over. Hendershot sat down and broke the news. It's over. It's over. We have him, she told Sarah. Both women sat in the booth, tears running down their faces. That's where I got my happy moment, if you will, was when I got to sit in front of her and tell her that after all of this, after everything that you've been through, you'll never, ever have to worry about him again, Hendershot says. Michael O'Leary could not understand what was happening. He had driven up to the house at 65 Harlan Street and found it swarming with cops. A crowd ringed the police tape. News crews stood outside, the reporters speaking into cameras. He got out of his car and identified himself to a cop. He was handcuffed and placed into the back of a squad car. Now, he was sitting in a room in the headquarters of the Colorado Bureau of Investigation. 2 detectives sat in front of him. One introduced himself as Scott Burgess. The other identified herself as Edna Hendershot. So, do you have any idea what this might be about? Burgess asked. Heck no. I have zero idea, Michael replied. He knew that his brother had been arrested, but he didn't know why. He'd seen a story on TV about a guy in Arizona arrested for shooting a bunch of people. The guy had reminded him of his brother, a loner, off-the-grid type. Had Mark been building a bomb or something? You don't get this kind of treatment for a traffic ticket, Burgess told him. Burgess and Hendershot fired questions. How did he spend his days? He went to barber school each morning at 8 and worked at a furniture delivery store in the afternoons. Had he ever driven Mark's pickup anywhere? Yeah, once. He had used the truck to drop off a television stand somewhere in the Denver suburbs. Did he use the computer in the back room? Sure, but he had his own account with his own password. He checked fantasy football scores. Sometimes he perused a dating website called Plenty of Fish. Had he ever been to Aurora? Or Westminster? Or Golden? No? Yes? No. Do you have any cousins that live in the Denver area? Male cousins? Hendershot asked. Nope. There was just his dad, and he lived in Arizona. Burgess asked a final question. Could he pull up his pants legs? Michael showed him a scar on his calf. It had come from a bicycle accident when he was a kid. What did that have to do with anything? Are you guys going to tell me what he's been arrested for, or what? Michael asked. Burgess hesitated a second. It was a heck of a thing, telling this guy. He literally had no idea. Several women had been raped, Burgess told him. They had described their attacker as 6 feet tall, about 225 pounds. DNA had tied the rapist to the O'Leary family, and one woman had seen a birthmark on the rapist's leg. I'm sorry to tell you that, and I'm sorry to say that this is going to be something that is going to be difficult, I would imagine, for a family to deal with here, he told Michael. But we are very confident that Mark, unfortunately, is our suspect. Michael said nothing. Burgess and Hendershot continued to ask questions, but Michael stopped answering. Minutes passed in silence as the two cops waited for him to speak. Finally, he found his voice. This is just gonna kill my mom, he said. She's not gonna be able to handle this. I guarantee you that. Like, she's done. Her life is over. This is just going to eat her alive forever. It doesn't matter. There's nothing I can do about it. Nothing anybody can do about it, he said. He pressed Burgess. Were they sure they had the right guy? Maybe he was being framed? Burgess told him no. They'd found plenty of evidence at the house. In my mind, it's overwhelming, he told Michael. Michael didn't want to be disloyal to his brother, blood thicker than water and all that. But this was too much. I actually looked up to him and thought he was doing good. I don't know what to think anymore. I'm embarrassed. Like, I'm embarrassed to even show my face. He might as well be dead. He's going to be gone forever. Michael said, I wish I could just, like, shoot him. He told the detectives that his brother was involved in occult stuff, astrology, alchemy, secret societies. His brother and his friends subscribed to strange beliefs about the world's social order, he told the detectives. There were only two kinds of people, those at the top and the rest in their thrall. In their world, everything is broken down, like with alphas and bravos, he said. The words resonated with Burgess. The rapist had made a cryptic reference to Amber about wolves and bravos. Now, the rapist's brother was using similar words. Imagine laying that coincidence out for a jury. Could it be two different guys with the same secret philosophy? What are the chances? Here was a chance to fit another puzzle piece into place. Burgess asked, "Have you ever heard the term wolves and bravos?" "Yeah, wolves and bravos," Michael said. "What's wolves and bravos?" "The wolves are basically like alphas, and the bravos are just like the majority masses of the people. They're not physically fit. They're not mentally fit. They're not anything. They're just on the next level down. That's how they break it down, the same way wolves do, because that's how wolves break down."
Is that how he regarded himself? Was that the kind of stuff he was studying?
They basically classified him as alpha, and that alpha males in that society basically can have sex with multiple women. They don't have to be tied down, Michael said. I don't see how that ties into frickin' going out and raping and stuff like that. But I mean, it's just all way too deep to even try to think about, you know? The dude's fucking psycho, Michael said. As Montano stepped through O'Leary's house, she was followed by another man, John Evans, a 50-year-old computer expert. A civilian investigator with CBI, Evans knew that the rapist had threatened to post the victim's pictures on the internet, and that O'Leary owned pornographic websites. Evans's job was to scoop up all the computers, hard drives, and cell phones in the house. Montano was searching for physical signs of O'Leary's guilt. Evans was seeking digital ones. Evans had a long history with computers. As a young man, he had purchased one of the first computers made to use in the home, a Commodore 64. That was back in the 1980s. It couldn't do much. Add numbers, print hello, show blocky graphics. But he fell in love with the machine with the clunky brown keyboard and glowing screen. At the time, it seemed like magic. He turned his hobby into a career. After serving in the Navy, he had worked in Antarctica for 3 years, wowed by the polar nights and then days without end. Evans moved to Colorado. He got a job as an animal control officer, a dog catcher as they were once called, and then joined the Golden Police Department as an evidence clerk and a crime scene technician. Working mostly alone, in an office lined with shelves, he logged fingerprint cards and DNA swabs, pistols and photographs, bed sheets and torn clothes. His fascination with electronics led him to take classes in computer and video forensics, the analysis of digital media to use in court cases. He became a certified computer forensic examiner, the first in Golden and one of the few in the Denver region. Evans's reputation as a computer whisperer spread. Other agencies began sending him their computer crimes. At first, it was mostly around Golden, but soon, cops from around Colorado were asking him for help. "Did your case have blurry surveillance video? Evans could enhance it. Need to crack open a hard drive? Evans could do that too. Encrypted emails? Evans was the man to call." This was how Evans learned that computers contained black magic, too. Many of the cases he worked involved child pornography. That meant he had to spend long hours looking at the most disturbing images possible. He got to know the canon, the standard set of tens of thousands of photos and videos of sexually abused children that circulated on the internet among the world's perverts. It was never easy, never normal, but he got used to it, like cops with dead bodies. You build an immunity to it after a while. It was rough. At times, I just had to get up and walk away, he says. Evans kept his eyes alert for new images, ones he had never seen before. Those were the children he might still be able to save. In the back room, Evans inventoried each component of O'Leary's computer setup. There were two computers, one on his desk and one stored in the closet with the backpack and the guitar amp. There was an iPhone, two thumb drives on the bookshelves, the CD-ROMs, and two SSD memory cards in O'Leary's cameras, the stolen pink Sony Cybershot and the Canon Rebel XTI, the same model he had mentioned in his exchange with the woman on Craigslist. Evans transported everything back to the Rocky Mountain Regional Computer Forensics Laboratory, located in an uninspiring office park in Centennial, one of Denver's most southern suburbs. Funded by the FBI, the lab brought together federal agents and Colorado investigators to serve as a local crime lab for all things related to computer forensics. State law enforcement agencies would bring encrypted files, half-erased accounting records, internet IP logs, in hopes of turning up evidence of a crime. Evans, on permanent loan from the Golden Police Department as part of the FBI program, enjoyed the collaboration. "You try to help everybody out," he says. At his desk in a long floor filled with cubicles, Evans had seven computers, PCs and Macs, each with two screens. They whirred away, unearthing digitized secrets. Evans looked like a stockbroker on the floor of the Wall Street Exchange, but his 14 screens showed losses, never gains. "We're all looking at really bad stuff, all day long, every day." O'Leary's computer yielded evidence almost immediately. Evans found a backup of O'Leary's iPhone that contained the notes he had taken while he stalked Amber. The notes dated back to September 28th, more than 3 months before the rape. On that day, he recorded several entries over 5 hours spent outside the apartment. The last one was at 2:30 a.m. Amber comes home, strips to undies, and takes a really long time in the bathroom. Sits down at her desk and starts writing, he wrote. On November 10th, he described watching Amber and her boyfriend. Amber comes home with white BF about 10:30 to 10:45. BF in PJs, game over. On January 3rd, he worried that Amber might be moving out. He could see boxes being packed in her house. He picked the lock on the door that night to prepare for slipping into her apartment. "Got here about 1, home alone," he wrote one day before the rape. On the same iPhone, the investigators found evidence that O'Leary had been stalking another woman, a divorcee from Littleton. There was no sign that he had actually struck, just that he was planning to. The iPhone also divulged O'Leary's contacts. He didn't have many. There was his brother, Michael, his mother and stepfather, some local friends, and one number with a 602 area code. It was a woman from Arizona. Her name was Calixa. Evans forwarded everything he found to Galbraith or Hendershot. He'd write a quick, familiar note. "Here's a couple of interesting things found today." Evans's best friend was Mike Hendershot, Edna's husband. They'd met at the Golden Police Department, where Evans had also met Galbraith. Evans, too, was part of the Blue Web. Among the files that O'Leary had downloaded, Evans found an electronic copy of a book on police techniques, The Rape Investigation Handbook. It had been written by two streetwise cops who spent decades investigating sexual assault. John O. Savino, an ex-NYPD officer, and Brent E. Turvey, a criminal profiler. The handbook was written in a folksy style, with lots of anecdotes. Many of them were profiles of rapists and their crimes. But the book also described investigative techniques, the analysis of touch DNA, the use of VICAP, the characteristics of serial rapists. It seemed to Evans that O'Leary might have studied the book. He was a student of rape. One day, Evans stumbled onto a strange file stored on the hard drive of the computer that had been on O'Leary's desk. It had a suggestive name, Wretch. It was enormous, nearly 75 gigabytes, big enough to store all the books on a library floor, big enough to store tens of thousands of high-quality photos and videos, and it was sealed tight. Evans discovered that O'Leary had used the software program TrueCrypt to protect the file from prying eyes, eyes like his. Evans became obsessed with discovering the secrets of the Wretch. Though encrypted, the Wretch provided clues. O'Leary had transferred images into the Wretch for storage. That act, the moving of a folder of photos, left behind a record. Evans found that O'Leary had named one folder, Girls. Within it were more folders, each one with a woman's name. Evans found Amber's name and Sarah's name. He found Doris's name mentioned 1,422 times on 211 different files. He found 8 other names, too, names he didn't recognize. He put them aside. They might help investigators track down other victims. If you saw how meticulous he was, even with his underwear drawer, it was easy to understand why he labeled the folders with the women's names, Evans says. He was really careful about everything he did. Evans dedicated one of his computers entirely to hacking into the Wretch. As he waited, he applied his tools to the smallest things he had taken from 65 Harlan Street. The 2 memory cards from O'Leary's cameras, each was the size of a stamp. There, he found the evidence he was seeking, the photos of the victims. O'Leary had attempted to hide them. As far as Evans could figure out, O'Leary had transferred the photos from the camera into the Wretch. Then, with the images copied and stored in the safety of the Wretch, O'Leary deleted everything from the photo cards. Only he hadn't succeeded. The names of the files of the images had vanished, but the electronic bits that formed the images themselves remained on the card until permanently overwritten by another photo. The most careful of rapists had again left behind traces, digital ones. Using software to recover deleted files, Evans rescued more than 400 images of Amber, posed and photographed, her face a mask of fear. There were more than 100 images of Sarah, forced to lie sprawled on her bed, her hands tied behind her back. There could be no mistake. The man in the photos was O'Leary. And he was raping the women in exactly the way they had described. As he scrolled through the photos, Evan sometimes had to stop. He would go outside for a cigarette break. He estimated he had seen millions of pornographic images, many violent, many involving children, in his 25 years in law enforcement. But the people pictured in them had been anonymous and unknown. Now, he knew the names of the terrified faces staring at him on his computer screen. You couldn't sit there and go through it all, he says. It just gets to be a little overwhelming. It is real. You know you have a real victim out there. When Evans called Galbraith and Hendershot to deliver the news, they raced over to the lab to view the files and immediately identified their victims. Endershot's succinct assessment, I can't think of a more vile human being. Hendershot noticed one picture where Sarah was wearing a pair of chunky red sandals. She recalled seeing them in a box when she had searched Sarah's apartment. Sarah had said the rapist put shoes on her, but she couldn't remember what they were. Hendershot decided to try one more time. She called Sarah. After chatting a few minutes, Hendershot asked her the same question she had asked before. Any chance that Sarah could remember the shoes? As a matter of fact, she could. Sarah told her that she had been looking at a photo album a few weeks ago and saw a picture of herself wearing red sandals. Her memory suddenly flashed. Those were the shoes the rapist had grabbed. Hendershot was amazed. 6 months after the rape, Sarah's traumatized brain had recovered a lost image. Her memory was still finding puzzle pieces, still fitting them together. Evans continued to unearth files that O'Leary thought he had deleted. He found 8 photos that had been taken years before. They had been part of a bigger set, but most of the images had been overwritten as O'Leary had raped more women and taken more pictures. One more attack, and the 8 images would have shared the same fate, vanishing forever. Instead, Evans managed to recover them. He reviewed the photos with Galbraith. They were pictures of a young woman. She wore a pink t-shirt. She had the same look of terror as the other women. Galbraith's heart sank. Another O'Leary victim. But how would she find her? The last photo provided the answer. Mark O'Leary had placed the woman's learner's permit on her torso. Click. The image clearly showed her name and her address. Linwood, Washington. Chapter 13. Looking into a Fish Tank. Monday, August 11th, 2008. Before 7:55 a.m., Linwood, Washington. He arrived in the pre-dawn hours, then waited outside her apartment, outside her bedroom, listening to her talk on the phone. The night was dry, letting him settle in. The wall was thin, letting him hear her voice. He liked trees for the cover they provided, and this complex had plenty of them. Apartments didn't offer him the privacy of a house, but still, there were advantages. All those sliding glass doors, for one thing, ridiculously easy to pick when they weren't left unlocked, which so often they were. And then there were the windows. There were times he could dwell in the dark and run his eyes across the building, every blind open, every light on. It was like looking into a fish tank. He'd spotted her a couple of weeks before. He'd been out driving, scoping out apartment complexes, looking for ones that fit his criteria. He wanted a complex that offered opportunities for concealment, ways to duck for cover. If the outside was open and bright, he'd be exposed. He wanted bedroom windows he could look through. He wanted the apartment to offer multiple escape routes. He didn't want to get boxed in. Sometimes, appraising a complex, he'd go into an empty apartment, maybe a model unit, to study the layout and mark exactly what was where. He also wanted the complex to be at least a mile from his home. "You don't shit where you eat," he'd say. Her complex was 4 miles away, a 10-minute drive. And he found himself in Linwood a lot, to shop, like everyone else. Circuit City, Fred Meyer, Best Buy, Walmart. He ate here at Olive Garden and Taco Bell, and sat in the dark, smoky interior of Secret Garden, a local Korean barbecue restaurant. Just last week, he'd been at the Alderwood Mall, shopping at Barnes & Noble. Linwood had plenty of neighborhoods that were mostly houses, and houses had their appeal. In addition to greater privacy, they offered greater predictability. With people in houses, there tended to be less coming and going. There were fewer people to account for. But an apartment complex was easier to prowl, easier to drive through, or walk past, or just stand in front of without being conspicuous. There, he could blend in. Still, he knew he couldn't stay in one place for too long, even in a complex like this. So, a couple of times, he left his position outside her bedroom and walked around, just for a while, lest he raise suspicion. Then he returned and listened. He knew she was on the phone because no other voice responded to her. He waited for her to fall asleep. She was 18 years old. His preference was 18 to maybe 30. Monstrous as he was, there were limits to his depravity, or at least that's what he told himself. 18 was as young as he'd go. He also avoided homes with children because he didn't want them caught up in this. His preference was single women living alone. He also avoided places with dogs because dogs barked. Dogs were worse than security alarms. Aside from her age, she wasn't his type, not really. He'd realized that before while peeping into her bedroom. But he spent so much time hunting, that's what he called it, hunting. Hundreds of hours, maybe even 1,000, that he had conditioned himself to incorporate into his fantasies as many kinds of women as possible. He had been in Washington for 2.5 years now. After leaving Korea, he had moved here and joined the Army Reserve, tasked with training ROTC cadets. He reported to Fort Lewis, but lived in Mount Lake Terrace, north of Seattle. In Washington, his early attempts were often as pathetic as those two in Korea. He couldn't say for sure how many times he had failed. "I don't even know," he'd say. "Quite a few," he'd say. "At least 7 or 8, he'd say, if pushed. One of those times, he went into a woman's bedroom, knife in hand, and when she saw him, she ran right past him, just like that, and he let her go. If he grabbed her, he might cut her, and he didn't want to do that. All the work he had done, all the preparation, ran out the door with her, into the night. It was foolish what she did, but a part of him respected it. Another time, he was prowling a condominium and saw a woman who looked to be in her 60s, but he couldn't see her well. The backyard was exposed, so he watched her from behind a fence in some woods, maybe 10 to 15 yards away. He waited, then went into her home. She had the television on. He went into her bedroom and saw her asleep. She looked pretty old, enough to make him wonder. "I don't know about this," he thought to himself. He spent 15 or 20 minutes debating. Then he went to the bed and covered her mouth to keep her from screaming. She looked so terrified that he worried she might have a heart attack. He pulled down the covers and realized he couldn't do it. She was too old. He covered her back up. He told her, "I made a mistake coming here. I'm not going to steal anything. I'm not going to hurt you. I'm sorry I scared you. Please don't call the cops. I'm going to walk out the back door." And he did. But then he stewed. In the days and weeks after, he chastised himself. "You're wasting your life. You spend night after night prowling, preparing, and then, if a woman doesn't fit your fantasy, you walk away." So he committed himself to expanding his fantasy realm. He sought out pornography featuring older women, then watched and watched. He made sure the next time his wiring would be different, the next time his work would not be wasted. Her phone call went on and on. As she spoke with Jordan, Marie noticed something in the dark, but she didn't think much of it. "It was outside my window, just a shadow. Maybe someone walking by," she thought. The shadow was there, then gone. By the time her voice died out, it was 15 minutes before sunrise. He climbed over the railing, brushing the surface. On the back porch, there was a storage closet. He walked past it to the sliding glass door. The door was unlocked. He went into the living room. He knew the apartment's 644 square feet, the living room that opened into the small dining area that led to the bedroom door. Since spotting her 2 weeks back, he had broken into her home a couple of times so he could check the place out. He'd gone through her papers and searched the drawers in her bedroom to make sure she would have no weapon within reach. There was a learning curve to what he did. He put it this way. As you become more proficient, you make fewer mistakes. That's a word he would use, proficient. He had an entire vocabulary for rape. His words dehumanized and often mimicked military lingo. A nest of apartment buildings was a target-rich environment. While conducting surveillance, he wanted multiple potentials to pursue. He called his final prep on the night of when he would be just outside, inventorying mask, bindings, gloves, pre-combat inspection. By this time, he was maybe halfway around that learning curve. He'd slipped up before, catching the attention of police. In April of 2007, an officer in Mount Lake Terrace had stopped him at 5 a.m. The cop didn't arrest him, but he took his name and wrote a report. Subject, prowling around apartments and residences wearing dark clothing. He gave the cop some bullshit story about his car breaking down and knocking on doors to use someone's phone. But for the next couple of weeks, he noticed cops driving by his home, going slow, eyeballing. Shit, he thought to himself. I'm on their radar. After that, he shut down for a while. He knew that his fixations and his creeping about had also given people around him reason to wonder. He'd come home in the morning to Masha, his clothes dirty, as though he'd been crawling through something. He took classes at the Art Institute of Seattle, where he paid a fellow student, a photographer, to take pictures for a website. The student showed up to discover a photo studio with fetish gear and a metal cage with latch and padlock. Three women modeled naked. They were, in the photographer's words, dangerously skinny. His marriage was unraveling. It was so bad he had asked for an open marriage. It was so bad she had agreed. Masha had worked to support them while he sat at his computer for hours on end, pretending to do web design, while really he was beginning his foray into the porn business. Between the websites and the prowling, his obligations to the military suffered. He had become a no-show at Battle Assembly, the Army Reserve's monthly training drills. It had been a year since he even made contact with his commanders. In the living room, just on the other side of the sliding glass door, he saw a pair of black tennis shoes. Hers. He removed the laces and placed the shoes back down. A police detective would later note how precisely the shoes had been arranged, as though something in the tidiness didn't square. He was just being neat, the way he was with everything. He threaded one of the shoelaces through a pair of her underwear, the other lace he planned to use for binding. He didn't pack the same equipment every time. Sometimes he brought handcuffs or blindfolds. Other times he made do with what he could find. Sometimes he brought a gun. On this occasion, he would use a weapon he had spotted in one of his earlier canvases of the apartment. As his fantasies evolved, so did his packing list. Tonight he planned a first for him. Tonight he brought a camera. Inside the apartment, he spent a half hour getting ready, maybe longer. Part of it was mental, talking himself over the cliff, to use his words. In the kitchen, he went to the knife block and removed a black-handled blade from the top row, far left. Then he walked to the bedroom. Around 7 a.m, maybe a quarter till, he stood in her bedroom doorway, the knife raised in his left hand. He watched as she awoke. "Turn away," he told Marie, and she did. Roll over onto your stomach, he told her. When she did, he straddled her, putting the knife near her face. Put your hands behind your back, he told her. He bound her wrists and covered her eyes. He stuffed cloth into her mouth to muffle any sound. That was an interesting conversation you were having, he told her, letting her know he had been there, listening and waiting. You should know better than to leave the door unlocked, he told her. Roll back over, he told her, and she did. And then he raped her. And while he raped her, he ran his gloved hands over her. He found her purse, dumped it out, picked up her learner's permit, put it on her chest, and took pictures. Marie heard the rustling, but couldn't make sense of it. She recognized the click of a camera, a sound she knew well. Unable to speak, unable to scream, she prayed. She prayed that she would live. When he was finished, he said that if she told the police, he would post the photos online so that her kids, when she had kids, could see them. He took out the gag and removed the blindfold, telling her to avert her eyes and keep her head in the pillow. One of the last things he said was that he was sorry. He said he felt stupid, that it had looked better in his head. He left the room, walked to the front door, and was gone. On August 14, 2008, the same day Marie was taken to the Linwood police station and interrogated, pressed into saying she had made up her story, Mark O'Leary dropped into Linwood Gun and Ammunition, a store off Highway 99. He bought 4 boxes of ammo and a rifle. The following month, he registered 5 more pornographic websites, including teensexhub.net and porninjector.com. The month after that, he was in Kirkland, east of Seattle, raping another woman, 63 years old, his modus operandi almost identical to the rape in Linwood, right down to using the victim's own shoelaces as binding. The next year, he was discharged from the Army Reserve. While he had received an honorable discharge from active duty, for the reserve, the conditions were other than honorable. On a list of values, the rating binary, yes or no, he received a no on everything. Loyalty, duty, respect, selfless service, honor, integrity, personal courage. His evaluation report said, cannot be counted on to accomplish any task, even those assigned to lower skill levels. He had been unaccounted for about 2 years. In the summer of 2009, O'Leary got on Interstate 90 and left Western Washington. He drove east and south, going over the mountains to Yakima. Then he picked up Interstate 84 to Baker City, Oregon, Burley, Idaho, Ogden, Utah, and caught I-80 to Rock Springs, Wyoming. He continued east through Wyoming, almost to Nebraska, then turned south, home to Colorado, where he would settle in the outskirts of Denver and begin anew. Chapter 14. A Check for $500. March 2011, Linwood, Washington. For Detective Galbraith, this was a call to look forward to. She would be helping another police department tie up a major case, extending a hand from 4 states away. Hey, look what I have for you. Or at least that's what she figured. When she called the Linwood police, it was Thursday, March 3rd, Galbraith identified herself, then provided Marie's name and asked if the department had any case reports involving her. Told yes, Galbraith asked for a copy. Fax us your request on letterhead, the Linwood police said. They wanted to confirm that Galbraith was a cop. So Galbraith grabbed some stationery emblazoned with her department's police shield and typed, "Please forward this CR to my attention at your earliest convenience. We have four similars with a person in custody. Thanks in advance, Stacy." About 20 minutes later, Galbraith received a fax from Linwood's records department. She looked at the cover page and looked again, seizing at what was scrawled across the bottom. There, written by hand, were the last words she expected to see. "Vic was charged with false reporting in our case." False reporting. The woman in the photo. Vic was charged. Galbraith startled at the words. Her heart sank, then she let out a curse, knowing just how wrong the charge was. Galbraith told the officers around her, "Hey, listen to this." Then she went through the file. The investigations in Colorado had generated thousands of pages of records documenting leads chased, lab work conducted, canvases completed. The facts from Linwood included only 44 pages. Galbraith pored over what little there was. She read what Marie had told police that first day about being attacked. Galbraith knew, because of O'Leary's photos, that Marie's account was true. The images matched Marie's words. She wouldn't be helping fellow investigators solve an open case, Galbraith realized. She would be notifying them of an unthinkable mistake, about the worst any detective could make. As she reviewed Linwood's investigation, seeing where the doubts started, how they spread, how Marie had buckled when challenged and even taken a plea deal, Galbraith could only imagine what the woman in the photo had gone through. And she could only imagine the days ahead for the Linwood police. Sergeant Mason was heading to work when he got the telephone call letting him know. 2 months before, he had been transferred from the Criminal Investigations Division to the Narcotics Task Force, the field he knew best. He was still picking up classes outside of work. He was wrapping up a course in criminal justice procedure at Skagit Valley College, earning an A to go with all the other A's lining his college transcripts. It had been 2.5 years since he had closed Marie's case, and in that time, he had not once second-guessed himself. "I had no indication that how the investigation concluded was anything but 100% correct." Mason's investigation had gone sideways with a call from Peggy, saying she suspected Marie was lying. Now, a call from Rodney Conheim, a fellow Linwood sergeant, informed Mason that Marie had been telling the truth. She had been raped. The man who raped her had been arrested. The police who arrested him had found photographs that verified Marie's story. Her unbelievable story. He had confronted a woman who had been assaulted at knife point, convinced her to recant, and charged her with a crime. In his car, alone, he absorbed the news. The shock was so profound, it reduced the surrounding details to fuzz. Most likely, he pulled off the road, although he doesn't remember. "It's the law. I'm sure I did." Most likely, Conheim offered support. "I'm sure he did, but it didn't register." He went into the station and met with higher-ups. Everyone around talked about reopening the investigation and extraditing O'Leary and notifying Marie and reimbursing her costs and expunging her record. And for Mason, it was all but a hum. Everyone around feeling horrible, not sure what to say to the detective in the middle of it all. As his colleagues set to work, Mason thought about the case, retracing the steps he took, mulling where he lost his way. The phone call from Peggy, the Project Ladder manager saying Marie wanted to change apartments. Marie, when asked to come in, saying, "Am I in trouble?" None, alone, meant much. but at the time, they seemed to add up. He'd been a cop for more than 20 years now, and for the first time, he questioned whether he was qualified for the job. Like every cop, he'd experienced trauma. He had seen death, faced danger, and he had acquitted himself. He had pulled through and moved on. This was different. And though in this moment he thought about himself and all he had to answer to, he thought more about Marie. If he could get something like this so wrong, should he keep doing what he was doing? Maybe it was time for him to quit. The investigators in Colorado not only helped solve the Linwood case from 1,300 miles away, they also helped close the case in Kirkland, Washington, with an assist from the Naval Criminal Investigative Service, or NCIS. In 2004, the NCIS created the Law Enforcement Information Exchange, LINX for short. To protect Navy assets, this program aimed to gather investigative records from law enforcement agencies at the federal, state, county, and municipal levels. A search of those records could illuminate patterns or connect cases across jurisdictions. By 2011, at least 275 agencies participated in the Northwest alone, sharing more than 13 million narratives of criminal investigations. That enthusiastic participation allowed the LINX program to achieve a power that the FBI's VICAP program never realized. After linking O'Leary to the rape in Linwood, Galbraith used this database to search for other unsolved cases in Washington State with similar markers. Up popped the case in Kirkland, where the 63-year-old grandmother had been assaulted 2 months after Marie. From there, everything fell together. A search of O'Leary's computer produced a hit on the Kirkland victim's name. O'Leary's DNA was compared to the genetic profile recovered from the grandmother's shoelace. It matched. Before filing charges in the Kirkland case, a prosecutor in King County, Washington, wrote to Galbraith, asking her to review a prepared summary of the evidence for accuracy. Galbraith marked up the document and wrote back, "File, file, file. Way bad dude. Have a great weekend." At the Linwood Police Department, the task of cleanup went to Commander Steve Ryder and to Conheim, the sergeant who had sat in on Marie's final, futile attempt to convince police the rapist was real. They needed to meet with their counterparts in Colorado, which figured to be humiliating, and to find Marie and tell her about O'Leary. "One of the worst things that we were ever going to have to do," Ryder says. They went to Colorado first. On March 14th, the two men introduced themselves to the two detectives who had caught the rapist. Although the Linwood officers reeled at their department's mishandling of the case, their approach to the aftermath left Galbraith with a sense of appreciation. They were nice. They were nice. You could tell that they had that victim's interest at heart in how they were going to try to fix this for her. They weren't arrogant. There was no wall. There was no feeling of, "We're on defense. It is what it is, and now we act." Galbraith and Hendershot gave a briefing on their cases and provided a copy of O'Leary's fingerprints obtained after his arrest. In Kirkland, the police had preserved their physical evidence, including the DNA that proved a match with O'Leary. But the Linwood police, upon concluding that Marie was a liar, had destroyed the bedding, the hairs, the fibers, even the rape kit, with all that evidence collected at the hospital when Marie did every awful thing asked of her in order to help the police catch the stranger with the knife. Any hope of a DNA match was gone. When they checked to see what was left, all the Linwood police found was a single card with some partial fingerprints lifted from the sliding glass door. That card, coupled with this copy of O'Leary's prints, was Linwood's only hope of proving O'Leary's guilt through physical traces left behind. The same day they met with the two Colorado detectives, Ryder and Konheim went to the Jefferson County Jail to see if O'Leary would talk. But once he heard who they were and what they wanted, he requested an attorney, shutting down any questioning. The next day, the two went to Lakewood, to the offices of the Colorado Bureau of Investigation. Together, in one room, investigators from all the agencies that had captured O'Leary in Colorado, Golden, Westminster, Aurora, Lakewood, the CBI, and the FBI, convened with the police from Linwood. The department that might have prevented the Colorado attacks had its detectives worked their case instead of closing it as unfounded. The meeting was not comfortable. We sat in a group of outstanding investigators that put together an unbelievably good case, solved this case for us, and we're in the room looking at each other like we don't even deserve to be here. Our department screwed this up so bad, Ryder says. They've got to be looking at us like, how could you let that happen? The Linwood officers were struck by how well the Colorado agencies worked together. Just the spirit of cooperation, Konheim says. They shared information. They held routine meetings. They all knew each other, Konheim says. You could see that communication wasn't forced or new. In Washington State, the police in Linwood had scuttled Kirkland's efforts to coordinate, even though the two cities were only 16 miles apart. Despite Shannon's tip, and her insistence the two cases might connect if only someone would look, detectives from the two departments never met in person. Nor did they write down and file whatever information was passed over the phone. The investigative files for both agencies offer not a word about contact between the two. In Colorado, Ryder and Konheim witnessed the power of relationships. They also saw that the police in Colorado had investigative tools the Linwood police did not. When the two returned home to Washington, they made sure their department got an automatic license plate reader. One trial concluded, Ryder turned to the next, the one he dreaded most. Now he had to tell Marie. Extraordinary as Marie's case was, a victim assaulted, then accused, others like it could be found around the country, reflecting, in some police departments, a dismissiveness toward reports of sexual violence that at times crossed into hostility. For Marie, vindication came through a photograph, an image, captured and saved by her rapist, confirming the truth of Marie's story. For a 13-year-old in White Bear Lake, Minnesota, it took video. In 2001, the 13-year-old reported being abducted and sexually molested, then dumped at a shopping mall. "You were never there. You never got dropped off there," a police detective told the girl. He told her he had watched surveillance video from the mall, which failed to back up her story. "You keep lying and lying and lying and lying," he said. More than a week later, the girl's parents reviewed the mall's surveillance tape for themselves and discovered footage showing that their daughter had been telling the truth all along. In Vallejo, California, Denise Huskins, a physical therapist, disappeared from her home in 2015. When she reappeared 2 days later, police detectives refused to believe her story of having been kidnapped and sexually assaulted, likening her account to the plotline of the best-selling novel, Gone Girl. The police called her story a hoax, with one lieutenant saying Huskins owes this community an apology. Several months later, the police discovered that Huskins' account was true. They found video of her being sexually assaulted, along with other evidence. A disbarred lawyer who had gone to Harvard pleaded guilty to kidnapping Huskins and was sentenced to 40 years. But even after that, Huskins continued to encounter abuse online, with one man posting on Facebook, "You are going to hell for the bullshit you have done. Eat shit, whore." Huskins, in a Facebook post of her own, wrote, "All I did was survive, and I was criminalized for it." In the United States, there's no saying how many women have been accused of making